This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. 40 years ago today, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis. Our next guest, Michael Honey, has written a book about the campaign on which King was working when he was killed. As Honey points out, although many people know that King died in Memphis, many don't know what he was doing there. He was joining forces with 1,300 black sanitation workers who were striking for the right to unionize. The strikers and their supporters turned Memphis upside down for 65 days in the winter of 1968. King saw his work in Memphis as part of a new direction in the civil rights movement, emphasizing economic equality. He said, quote, "We know that it isn't enough to integrate lunch counters. What does it profit a man to be able to eat at an integrated lunch counter if he doesn't earn enough money to buy a hamburger and a cup of coffee?" Unquote. Michael Honey's book is called Going Down Jericho Road. Honey is a professor of labor studies and American history at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He spoke with Terry Gross last year.
What was the Memphis sanitation workers' strike about, and what set off the strike?
It was about really this dignity for these workers and dignity for African Americans in a city that was still tied to the old plantation ways and thought it had solved its race problems, but really hadn't, and was very much a paternalistic, top-down, good old boy system, and Mayor Henry Loeb sort of represented that. But in terms of the strike, what set it off was just horrible working conditions.
Yeah, why don't you describe the conditions?
Well, most of these people worked as they identified them as casual laborers, and so they had no set hours. They could come in and work for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours until the job was done. They were never sure how much they were going to be paid for that work. They didn't have pensions. They didn't have vacations. They didn't have most of the things you would think you would have with a full-time job. And they were very expendable. They could be fired on a moment's notice. And on top of that, they were making poverty-level wages. 40% of those workers in the sanitation department were on welfare, even while they were working full-time jobs.
The slogan of the Memphis sanitation worker strike was, "I am a man," and "am" was underlined. What was the meaning the leadership wanted that slogan to have?
The "I am a man" slogan sort of emanated from the ranks of the workers. A lot of these workers were very religious, so they had a real conception of dignity and justice based on the Bible and their understanding of Christianity. And they wanted to be treated as human beings with respect. And it was an all-male workforce, so it was, "I am a man." But the whole black community took up this slogan. Everybody instantly recognized what this slogan meant. That it meant, "We want an end to the plantation mentality and the disrespect that white people show to black people every day of their lives."
What did Martin Luther King see as his role in the Memphis sanitation worker strike?
You know, I think King did in Memphis what he so famously did in so many places. You can really see why he was so important to the movement when you see what he did in Memphis. You know, there was a lot of backlash against King and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and some of the younger people in that period, because people would say, well, he'd come in, he'd make a speech, and then he'd leave. He'd get a lot of publicity, but we're still here doing the organizing. And some people resented that. But what actually transpired in Memphis was that the local movement went on for about 6 weeks, and they were really desperate to get some national media coverage. He came in, he brought the national media attention. Suddenly the national labor unions, AFL-CIO, George Meany, started to pay attention. Money started coming in to the strike to support it. And more than that, when King came in, he assessed the situation immediately and gave a brilliant speech on March 18th that just shook the place. And there were 15,000 people there at this speech, and he called for a general strike in Memphis of all black workers, domestic workers, garbage workers, teachers, students, everybody. Walk out and shut the city down. And if you hear the recording of that, people just went nuts.
We actually brought a copy of the recording with you. So I'd like you to play us an excerpt of it Would you introduce the excerpt that you'd like to play?
Yeah, what's happening here is that King has flown in from Los Angeles via Jackson, Mississippi. He's on the Poor People's Campaign. He's in himself in serious trouble. He's exhausted. The FBI is pursuing him every step of the way. They're wiretapping him. They've got informants in his organization. He comes to Memphis, and instead of what he's experiencing in many places, which is a lot of backlash against him because of his anti-war stand, even in the black community, a lot of people dissing him for opposing military action in Vietnam. Instead of that, he comes to Memphis, and people are so overjoyed to see him and so happy to have him come into their movement. And he responds to that by explaining in a way that almost nobody else could do why their strike was so important and why it was so important for the middle class to support the working class and the poor in this situation.
Okay, so this is Martin Luther King recorded on March 18th, 1968.
If we are going to get equality, if we are going to get adequate wages, we are going to have to struggle for it. Now, you know what? You may have to escalate the struggle a bit. If they keep refusing and they will not recognize the union and will not agree for the check-off of the collection of dues, I'll tell you what you ought to do, and you're together here enough to do it. In a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis. Not a Negro in this city will go to any job downtown. When no Negro in domestic service will go to anybody's house, anybody's kitchen.
It's an excerpt of Martin Luther King speaking on March 18th of 1968. And Michael Honey, so after Martin Luther King calls for this general strike, then you have to figure out, you know, the leadership had to figure out, well, what shape would the general strike take, and how do you keep it nonviolent? What shape did they want the general strike to take?
Well, unfortunately, there was no follow-up to this. Taylor Rogers, who was very active in the strike and later became the president of AFSCME Local 1733, said, well, you know, we never really followed that up. It was a great idea, and they were ready to do it on a kind of spontaneous basis, and King was then scheduled to come back in a few days and lead a mass march, and undoubtedly, if he had come back to do that, the students would have walked out of the schools, a lot of people would have refused to go to work. It would have been something like a general strike of black workers, but instead what happened was they had this incredible snowfall that just froze the Mid-South. It was a freak snowfall. And so King couldn't come back. And then they had to reschedule it, and he came back quite a bit later, and things had changed, and some of the energy had dissipated. And then a lot of divisions started to sort of emerge within the movement.
Well, although the general strike never happened, there was a big demonstration that did happen on behalf of the sanitation workers. Tell us about that demonstration and how it ended up in a confrontation with the police.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that King came in from New York City, where he was working on the Poor People's Campaign, and he came in very late. The march was supposed to start at 10 o'clock, and King was nowhere to be seen, and they didn't want to start without him. This is March 28th. It's, you know, by that time it's pretty hot in Memphis. And people were waiting around for him for an hour and a half or so. Meanwhile, students were walking out of the schools, and there was an incident at Hamilton High School where the police came in and attacked the students, beat some people up. One young woman was badly hurt, and the rumor spread that she had been killed. So all these students started coming downtown to gather for the march, and they were extremely agitated and angry. And at the same time, a lot of the street people around Beale Street, which is, you know, that famous street in Memphis of the blues and everything else, people who were pickpockets, petty thieves, not movement people at all, began to intersperse themselves into the march. And so when King finally did arrive, the march itself was sort of out of control. The marshals couldn't keep people together the way they wanted them to be. And when the march finally did start, somebody started breaking windows. And suddenly they were in a situation where King's leading a march, and behind him, windows are being broken, and it looks like a riot is about to happen.
That was a big fear that a lot of the organizers of the demonstration had, that somehow, like, younger people or other people latching onto the demonstration would become violent, and it would change the tone completely of the demonstration.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, this was the thing everybody was afraid about, having to do with the Poor People's Campaign itself. King was talking about taking masses of people to Washington, D.C., and as you remember, you know, we had the long, hot summers back then. Every summer, huge riots would take place in the inner cities, usually set off by a confrontation with the police. So what happened in Memphis was that King was suddenly put in that very situation that everybody was dreading. And King, at the front of the march, was suddenly confronted with a whole mass of police with their gas masks, their clubs, which were 4 feet long, their weapons drawn. And James Lawson, the ministerial leader, took King out of the march because he didn't want King to be in the position of leading a riot, one, and two, he didn't want King himself to get killed or badly hurt by the police. So when they pulled King out, then the police attacked. And it wasn't so much a riot of the people as it was a riot of the police. And when the police attacked, then it just spread and it became a riot of everybody. But, you know, actually, as riots go, it wasn't much. There was not that much damage. It wasn't an attack against people at all. It was an attack against property. People were stealing liquor out of stores. But, you know, how big of a crime is that? What was really bad about it was that the police just laid siege to the black community for the next 3 days, and they brought in the National Guard, and suddenly Memphis became a police state.
Let's hear an excerpt of a speech that Martin Luther King gave on April 3rd of 1968, and this was the day before he was killed. How long is the speech after the confrontation that we were just talking about?
The confrontation happens on March 28th, and then the National Guard is brought in, and there's martial law for about 4 or 5 days. They have a meeting in Atlanta to try to decide what to do about Memphis. And there's a lot of division within the ranks of King's own organization. They're angry that he went to Memphis, said, you never should have gone there. We didn't want you to do this in the first place. King walks out of the meeting, goes away for several hours. Finally, the staff realizes that they have to unify behind him, and he says, you know, I think we have to go back to Memphis or else I'm done as a leader. And so they finally agree to that, and they all come back on April 2nd, and then King comes in on April 3rd, and he's served with a federal injunction saying he cannot march. And in the past, King has always tried to not go against federal courts because the federal courts have been often on the side of the movement. So on April 3rd, he's giving this speech in the context of he's saying, I'm going to defy the federal injunction. We're going to march come hell or high water, and it's going to be a nonviolent march. So he's putting everything on the line.
And this speech is most famous for the end of the speech, in which he talks about how he's been to the mountaintop. But the part we're going to hear is specifically about the Memphis sanitation strike and the importance of supporting these striking sanitation workers. So here's Martin Luther King.
The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now, we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the articles. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fair to them, and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. Force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering, sometimes going hungry, going through dark and dreary nights, wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. And we've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. For when people get caught up with that which is right, and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping point short of victory.
That's Martin Luther King in Memphis on the day before he was killed. And my guest, Michael Honey, is the author of the book Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. The day after the speech that we've been talking about, Martin Luther King is assassinated. Did you learn anything that you didn't already know about his assassination when you were doing research for your book?
I learned some nuances. There are FBI files on King that fill up almost a whole room at the FBI research room in Washington, D.C. I didn't go through all those files because a number of scholars have gone through them in great depth. One of the things that they did was J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, instructed his agents not to pass on information to King when there was a threat against his life. So they knew there were threats on King when he was coming into Memphis, but they're not passing them on to King. So in addition to that, I found that there were about 40 police cars in that area of Memphis circling around. The police were everywhere. Once King was shot, the police came out of the woodwork. Jesse Jackson was there, and the New York Times interviewed him and said, what happened? He said, well, there was a shot, and all these police came charging to us, but clearly the shot came from somewhere else. We could hear the rifle shot over in the distance, but none of them were going toward where the shot was heard. They were going toward the balcony. So a lot of people were drawing this conclusion that the police already knew what the target was. Now, beyond that, we know that there was a reward out on King's life and that James Earl Ray somehow escaped, despite the fact that there were police everywhere, and was on his way to Rhodesia from England, I believe it was, when he was arrested. Now, a lot of people in the black community at the time did not believe the idea that it was just one person that came in and did it. I don't know what the answer to that is, but certainly King was not getting the protection that he should have gotten under the circumstances that existed at that time.
Michael Honey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Honey, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. His book, Going Down Jericho Road, examines what causes Martin Luther King Jr. was fighting in Memphis when he was assassinated 40 years ago today.